From Beijing to Berlin, from Singapore to South Carolina, from Cape Town to Canada, the world turns on business and commerce. And where there is such industry, disagreements are bound to happen. Sometimes these disagreements are resolved. For the rest of the time, they end up in the capable hands of professionals around the world. The dynamic and interesting stories of these individuals is what you will hear on this show, Tales of the Tribunal.
Welcome back to Tales of the Tribunal with Chris Campbell. I am your host, Chris Campbell, here to tell you another tale, another story from the wide, wide world of international dispute resolution. And if you can hardly believe it, we are already at the end of the road for season one of this show. It's hard for me to believe, too. And in fact, I am back to Europe after a fun summer taking some great interviews and being in the United States. I have returned to Europe. So let's dig into this final episode, shall we? So one more shout out to the Atlanta International Arbitration Society and the Global Arbitration Review as they host their event next week, September 8th through the 10th, on multiple perspectives in international arbitration. If you've been listening the past several weeks, you've heard all about it, and in fact, might be running down on the last few days to get your tickets left for the show if they're not already sold out. It's a great event. I'm sad to be missing it this year, but I've been in years past, and it is a jolly good time. All right, one more announcement, dear listeners, before we get into today's guest. As you know, if you watch the show on a regular basis, watch the show. If you listen to the show on a regular basis, we release these episodes usually every Thursday, and we've been doing so since the late spring up until now. Well, we are going to take at least a one-week break, maybe 2 weeks, in order to prepare a special series of episodes on a topic that I will reveal here in the next week or so. Don't worry, I will not be as cryptic as I was about this final guest, but I will say that I can promise you that the subject matter will not be moot. Okay, that is a very obvious hint, so I don't want to hear any more cryptic messages from folks saying, the riddle was too hard, or we couldn't get what the understanding was. In any case, I hope that you got that little nod, and if you know any folks that are participating in such activities, tell them to tune in a couple of weeks. And of course, I will reveal that on the usual channels here over the next week or so, and hopefully we will have some tips and useful things to say to you. So, getting into today's guest. Today's guest that I actually met back in my days when I was living and working in China, I attended the ICSID's 50th conference in Xi'an and met none other than the woman herself, Miss Catherine Rogers. That's right, Catherine Rogers is professor at Penn State University and the Queen Mary University in London, where she teaches on various topics in the world of international arbitration. She's written at length about ethics and transparency in international arbitration. Oh, and when she's not doing all of that, she also is the CEO and founder of Arbitrator Intelligence, which is doing all sorts of great work with data analytics in the world of international arbitration. So that is quite the mouthful. Catherine is a fascinating individual, and I really enjoyed this interview. We sat down on campus at Penn State and were able to talk through what she's been up to, both in the academic sense and then with Arbitrator Intelligence. So this last episode is full of good information. It's a longer episode. We do, in fact, try to keep it to about 30 minutes, but there was just too much good information in this episode to pass up. So sit back and get comfortable, or do whatever it is, what position you like to get into when listening to podcasts, especially about international dispute resolution, and enjoy the show. We will have some footnotes for you on the other side. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to Tales of the Tribunal with Chris Campbell. I am your host, Chris Campbell, here with a final episode, a final tale to tell you before we end this adventure that we've been on during season one of the show. So I've given you some very cryptic clues over the last couple of episodes where I may or may not be. And today we're going to reveal, dear listener, we are here at Penn State University's Launch Box, which is part of the Invent Penn State initiative. Catherine, what is that? What is the Penn State Launch Box?
Well, the Launch Box is actually relatively new to me. I've just recently discovered it as we reincorporated Arbitrator Intelligence into a tech startup. So Invent Penn State, I think, was the brainchild of President Barron, who developed it so that we could increase the number of important and really diverse innovations by Penn State faculty and students, and encourage commercialization and entrepreneurialization so that those inventions are no longer just university activities, but end up being beneficial to society at large.
Well, right. That was a lot. And in fact, I've told the listeners that out there in podcast land that we are talking with Catherine Rogers. Who is Catherine Rogers? Who are you? What do the people need to know?
I don't know. That's a question I ask myself when I get up every day. And every day the answer is a little different because I wear a lot of hats. So I am a professor of law at Penn State University at their law school. I'm an affiliate faculty member also with the School of International Affairs at Penn State. I also hold a position at Queen Mary, where I both teach ethics and international arbitration, and I am a co-director of an institute on regulation and ethics.
And all that by 5 a.m.
Yes, it's 6 a.m. After I've had my coffee, I'm a former co-chair of the ICA Queen Mary Task Force on Third-Party Funding. I write on ethics and international arbitration and have a book on that. I do a lot of capacity building all over the world, which is one of the most exciting things that I do. And most recently, I'm now the founder and CEO of a new legal tech startup called Arbitrator Intelligence, which in its previous life was a nonprofit organization.
Right. And so we'll just continue right on to that point, actually, after also mentioning that Catherine has not mentioned this in introduction, but is also the coach of the defending Nittany Lions in the Beast Boot competition of this past year. So congratulations on that.
Okay, how could I have forgotten that? I'm actually just the faculty advisor, and that's because most of the credit goes to our student coaches and our incredibly hardworking team. But it is definitely one of the greater joys of being here at Penn State.
Well said. And so that last thing that you mentioned, CEO. So tell us about that CEO role. I mean, how is what Arbitrator Intelligence is? Well, tell us first what Arbitrator Intelligence was doing in its former life, and then tell us, you know, kind of what's going on with the Arbitrator Intelligence now.
Yeah. So the big difference is mainly the legal status. In many ways, we remain committed to our original goals and our mission statement, which is to promote transparency, accountability, and to greater diversity in international arbitration. We were doing it as a nonprofit, and one of the greatest joys in my life was seeing how excited young people were to join our effort to help us. We could never have become what we are today as a startup if it weren't for our amazing ambassadors that promoted us and got us the data that we're now using to become a startup. So a huge shout out to our amazing ambassadors all over Latin America, all over Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, and a number of other volunteers who've just jumped in from all over the world. But it's that energy and it's that bringing together of stakeholders through our nonprofit status that's actually allowed us today to transition into a startup. Now, that transition was necessitated because we need to get funds to be able to essentially bring to market, to scale up, is what they say in startup land, with our product, which is going to be coming out and available for sale by December. We're really excited about it because as we're looking at these initial samples, we see the power of data and the power of information that is secret and whose secrecy and confidentiality we actually maintain, but that we can nevertheless make available to parties, to their counsel, to arbitral institutions, okay, so that they can use it to make more intelligent, more efficient, more predictable decisions about arbitrator appointments.
Sure. And so for the uninitiated, for the folks that aren't familiar with Arbitrator Intelligence yet, what is the product? I mean, what do you get when you use Arbitrator Intelligence?
So the product is what we are calling Arbitrator Intelligence Reports. These are individual reports on a particular arbitrator. And what they do is they highlight their track record and they analyze it in comparison with relevant industry baselines and with other individual arbitrators' track records. This is what we would call descriptive analytics, in part because we were talking about relatively small data compared to what, for example, might be available for judges. But even with this descriptive analytics, it's incredible the kinds of insights you can get about an arbitrator's history that no matter how many phone calls you make or how many Google searches you do, you could never be able to find because this is all confidential information.
So this is data analytics on arbitrators.
Exactly.
I mean, that is a huge undertaking. How did Arbitrator Intelligence go about getting all that?
That is in a sense, the secret we were talking about with regard to the transition from a nonprofit to a for-profit. We had, to this date, we have over 850 questionnaires that have been responded to. We call these our arbitrator intelligence questionnaires. And the questionnaire basically asks someone, an attorney, a law firm, or a party, not the arbitrator or the tribunal secretary, not an arbitral institution, to complete the questionnaire and give us all the relevant data about an arbitration, except that confidential data, such as, for example, most obviously, the party's names.
Right, right. Okay. And so is, you know, so these detailed reports and these data analytics, is that the primary crux of arbitrator intelligence, or is there some other add-ons or some additional features that are included in that?
So right now we're starting with these individual reports because they plug in best to essentially how arbitrators are currently selected. And what's amazing is that we are finding arbitrators who are sort of some of the best kept secrets on the planet. Arbitrators who are phenomenally well regarded within a sort of region, but are not known globally. And that brings us back, even as a private entity that's, you know, for profit, to our original starting point, which is promoting diversity. We concentrated in collecting AIQs and getting this data from arbitrators outside of North America and Europe. So the most data we have right now is on Latin American arbitrators and on arbitrators from Central and Eastern Europe, again, thanks to our amazing ambassadors. And when we start putting together reports on those arbitrators, we're seeing that they are, some of them produce awards at record rates in high stakes, large scale arbitrations. We are getting data on whether they have granted or denied document production. What is their track record in granting bifurcation, in granting interim relief? We have questions in there about their interpretive methodology. Would you describe the way they interpreted the contract as plain meaning, as relying on negotiation history, relying on case precedent, as relying on instead business common sense or fairness and equity? And even just receiving that information without even seeing the awards, we are seeing distinctive patterns that develop as among different arbitrators.
And you mentioned something in your answer there that is something that we've talked about a lot on this show, and that is this topic of diversity, whether that be in the gender context, the ethnic context, the background context. How does arbitrator intelligence really aid in that effort to be more diverse and have more diverse tribunals?
So one, there was a survey done by Berwyn, Paisner, and Leitner several years ago. Now, Brian Cade, Berwyn, Paisner, Leitner, I'm not sure I know exactly the right name. And they found that the two characteristics that parties say they are looking for by either 90% or 92% is expertise and efficiency. And like I like to say, well, you know, those are really great qualities in an arbitrator, but A, they're not on their CVs. Okay. B, what makes for an efficient or an expert arbitrator differs not only from case to case, but if you ask the two parties in a single case, they probably have different opinions about what that means. And C, they've done studies in the United States that show that cognitive biases, those kind of biases that creep in, even if we don't know it, can be most active and most pernicious when you're using vague, abstract qualities. Okay, what we do at Arbitrator Intelligence is we disaggregate those qualities. So what does it mean to be efficient as an arbitrator? Well, it means that you render the award in a timely fashion. It means that the entire arbitration doesn't take 5 years, depending on the size.
Hopefully.
There are some arbitrations that, you know, for various reasons, including the parties, you know, rulings, have to take 5 years.
Sure, yes.
But you can measure efficiency quantitatively, right? And you can essentially disaggregate that quality. And in fact, that's what parties really want when they're choosing an arbitrator. They want to know what is their actual track record. And what we are hoping to do is essentially increase parties' ability to be precise and therefore increase the predictability in what they're choosing in an arbitrator. That's one of the main reasons parties go to arbitration, is to be able to choose their arbitrator. But we nevertheless rely on currently, for the most part, collective gossip instead of detailed understanding. And if you call around, which is what's the primary, you know, technique now, if you call around and let's say you get lucky, you talk to three or four people who know this arbitrator from a previous case, You don't know if those previous cases are outliers, okay, or if they are typical of this arbitrator. With our data, we can tell you, and we can help you understand what are the patterns that emerge from this arbitrator's previous track record.
And what's really interesting, Catherine, is that with this rise of machine learning, with artificial intelligence, there seems to be this increase or groundswell of tech and innovation in law. Are there any other companies or organizations that are doing something similar, or, you know?
There are some entities that, for example, are working to create more information about arbitrators. There are some that are trying to work on analytics, but they are either relying primarily, to my understanding, on publicly available information, right, which is a tiny infinitesimal.
You're just a sliver.
Sliver of what's really needed, right? And a subset of arbitration cases. Or they are relying on publicly available sources or self-reporting by arbitrators. They're all commendable efforts and they're all excellent. But I don't think they're going to be able to have the impact that arbitrator intelligence has because we are just coming at this from a totally different place. And I should add, you know, we are not trying to just provide a service or a product that makes a little bit quicker some piece of the arbitrator selection process. Longer term, I think we are going to be reshaping the market for arbitrator services. Why? Because we are systematically making more transparent information about arbitrations from which we can extract the data about arbitrators' track records. Now, what we can also do with that data is about 100 different things, which are longer term. We're starting with, again, what I think is the biggest need in the arbitration community, which is more carefully analyzed and more precise data about arbitrators.
And so what would you say, if you had to put it into a sentence or two, is the thing that sets arbitrator intelligence apart from any competitors that may exist?
So I'm not going to say anything about competitors per se, but I will tell you this, our long-term goal is to essentially become the standard. I like to analogize it to, for example, the mark on organic food, right? You wouldn't buy something that purports to be organic unless it has that certification mark or the good housekeeping seal of approval in the United States. We ultimately want to be the good housekeeping seal of approval for international arbitrators, with the idea that if an arbitrator is part of our network, meaning that they consent to have reports published about them because you will have to obtain the arbitrator's consent, it means that they're not afraid of being held accountable. They're not afraid of the feedback that they might get. And we are, I should add, we have a whole program in place to make sure about the quality and the reliability and the respectability of that feedback. But I think when an arbitrator says, I'm not afraid of that, it signals to the marketplace that they take seriously and are willing to be responsible for the decisions that they make. And that, I think, is something that parties are looking for right now. And that is something I think that they deserve when they pay these kinds of prices that they do for arbitrator services. I think institutions are going to benefit also tremendously. Institutions, one of the most important things they do is appoint arbitrators. And we're seeing this, you know, groundswell of new institutions in regions and countries that are trying to build up a local arbitration practice. Well, if they have to appoint arbitrators, but they are new and they don't have a big track record, that also means they don't have a big body of data from which to make reasonable and responsible appointments. One of the things we will do, sort of as a testament to the intersection of our nonprofit roots and our continued development of the product, is we will be providing arbitral institutions that engage in a cooperation agreement with us free access to all of our reports. So when they're trying to choose an arbitrator and they need a report on that arbitrator because that arbitrator has sat in several arbitrations but on the other side of the world, okay, they can see how that arbitrator performed and decide to appoint that person. That goes back again to this question of diversity, right? What we will be doing through arbitrator intelligence is globalizing the market for international arbitrators and integrating it much more. Because right now what you have is some Latin American arbitrators are known quite well within Latin America, and some Central and Eastern European arbitrators are known quite well. But if all the arbitrations they've sat in are secret, okay, it's impossible for people outside of the closest part of the region to know about them and to know that as our data is showing, parties are extremely happy with most of these arbitrators. You know, the vast majority of arbitrators are getting quite good feedback. And the parties, actually, one of the things that's kind of a fun fact is most of the parties so far who are completing our questionnaires are reporting that the final awards are as good or better than their clients were expecting. We think that's important because it's also, to some extent, a testament to the job that international arbitration is doing generally. That might be a throwaway question.
Sure. Yeah, we'll figure it out. So this is editing point six. Two more questions I was going to ask to round out the discussion about arbitrator intelligence was first, I don't know if you saw it. Well, you may have seen the Supreme Court case, or you might have seen the discussion that was going on about it in Young OGMID. But there was this talk, I guess, about this French Supreme Court decision that was, you know, basically prohibiting technology that allows you to analyze. You know the conversation, you don't know what I'm talking about? Does that affect you guys in any way?
So we will see. I actually, interestingly enough, I think part of the political or social pressure that produced that law, mm-hmm. which, by the way, I think is, you know, a terrible mistake. And I, especially for my friends over at Ravel Law who do judicial analytics, I don't know that they're planning to expand into France, but it does, you know, they're proof that judicial analytics can be very good for us and healthy for a system, I think. On the other hand, I think that to the extent that there is concern about, here's why I don't think it will, I think the law, as I understand it, and I've not read the French version or received legal advice on it yet, sure. but as I understand the French version, it's clearly aimed at courts as opposed to arbitrators. And part of the reason I would imagine that they have such a law like that in a civil law country mm-hmm. is in part because of the history of courts, which are not supposed to, judges are not supposed to speak in their individual voice so much as to be historically, and it's a little bit of an exaggeration, but la bouche du roi, the mouth of the king, right? That they're supposed to just interpret the law and not necessarily have unique personality or personal interpretations, let's say. For arbitrators, on the other hand, particularly because they're chosen by the parties, my sense is the same political motivations that might be adverse to such analytics for judges might nevertheless welcome it for arbitrators. I think in Europe in particular, there is a strong press for greater accountability for arbitrators. Which I think data analytics is one of the few ways you can really see what they've been doing to be able to talk about accountability. And I think that they recognize that when, you know, because an arbitrator is not appointed by the state, other mechanisms for accountability, other mechanisms for tracking them are important. So, again, I'm not familiar personally with the law and I haven't had legal advice. I do also hope they will change it because I don't think it's a right approach. But I don't think it should be something that I don't think the same political motivations that motivated that law will necessarily translate over to arbitrators.
Great. Okay. All right. So last question before we shift from arbitrator intelligence. For those of us, you know, that are on the outside of arbitrator intelligence that are watching the developments, what should we be watching for? What's the next big development for those of us watching?
Oh, yes. Okay. So we've literally been incorporated as a startup for less than a month, but that's why we're here in Invent Penn State to come back to where we started from. Invent Penn State, like many universities, have these programs. And so I am in what might be called CEO boot camp. I'm learning everything about running a corporation, about launching a product, about marketing, about product development. It's both exciting and exhilarating and mind-boggling. It's a huge transition for me, also at a personal level, a deeply personal level, because it's not the way I sort of see myself. But I'm getting used to it very quickly because you realize, actually, if you have some money and you're not doing it all by yourself with a couple good buddies and a bunch of volunteers, you can really make progress very quickly on a totally different scale. And that has been exhilarating. Plus, I have to say, the people at Invent Penn State are so smart and have been such fantastic guides that we have come a million miles in this last month. So we've been incorporated by the entrepreneurialism clinic at the Launchbox. We have the IP clinic that's representing us in our negotiations with Penn State because they own the intellectual property that was developed behind arbitrator intelligence. And working with all these different resources has been, for me, just absolutely amazing and truly transformative.
Great. No, it sounds like quite the adventure. So the takeaways, we'll stay tuned and watch
for the. Well, you asked. Sorry, I didn't fully answer your question, which was, what should we expect next? Expect to see the sample reports. They are so cool. We've been working on them intensively for the last long before we incorporated. We've been working on them, but they are really exciting, and the revelations you see in them are amazing. Plus, and I want to give a shout out here. If all goes well, we should also be running our next campaign, a new iteration of the campaigns. Instead of being run as these kind of volunteer efforts, we are collaborating with a major, might I even say the major, MENA region, Middle East, North Africa region law firm that's going to help run the campaign. Our hope is that at the end of the campaign, we might organize an event that will not only highlight some of the fascinating things we found out about arbitrators during the campaign, but also about the region and the arbitration centers. Because the data we get isn't just about the arbitrators, obviously, but it's about trends that are happening in the region. So we might be able to compare, for example, the timing, certain patterns of across the region in different categories that are important to parties, especially if they're trying to decide, do I want to seek my arbitration in the MENA region, or if I get an arbitrator from the MENA region, what might they bring to this case in terms of perspective and advantages and disadvantages?
That sounds awesome. We'll be looking for our invitation to the event, our press pass and everything in the mail. Okay. So shifting just a little bit from arbitrator intelligence, this is how we do the back half of all of our shows. We do some rapid fire questions. So first question, what are you reading? What books are you reading right now?
I'm still in the middle of this enormous but super interesting tome called Frederick Douglass. It's actually, he wrote three autobiographies, but this is a separate biography of him that's really very interesting. And it teaches you a lot about your own country that you didn't know. Even if I thought I had known a lot about this, the era, and he's also just a fascinating figure.
Absolutely.
Absolutely mesmerizing, I think, might be the word. He's, and they have a lot of excerpts from his speeches in it that are really quite amazing.
What's the name of the book?
It's literally called Frederick Douglass.
Frederick Douglass, okay.
I don't know if you'll be able to remember the name of the author if you ask me, except you could look, if you just look for the biggest book on Frederick Douglass, that's probably it.
Sure. Okay. Last movie you saw?
Great movie. In this time when everything is so depressing, there's this wonderful movie called The Public.
The Public. Okay.
The Public. And the reason why it's wonderful is because it reminds you of public service. It's about a library and a librarian. And it's about, Chicago night that's freezing cold and the homeless people are at risk of freezing to death. And it's a library. And it's about the head librarian and the humanity he shows them and how they resolve a seemingly epic stand down with the police who want to physically evict them from the library. It's a wonderful film. And it was one that I don't know how I even heard about it because I didn't see it advertised, but it's a feel good film, but not in a cheap way.
That's in theaters.
No, I saw it. It was a download. I can't.
Okay.
So it's not in theaters anymore. Sorry, but it's Emilio Estevez is the director.
Okay.
I think the author, the writer, and he's the lead librarian.
Oh, well. Hey, cool.
Yeah, new incarnation for Emilio Estevez.
I know, right?
That's his club, right?
Right. Don't you forget about us.
Exactly.
Okay, and let's see. Rounding out this section, what kind of music are you into? What do you like to listen to?
Oh, I think I have notoriously bad taste in music.
Yeah?
I have no taste in music. I listen to a little bit of everything. So on my radio on the way over here, I'm quite partial to Italian songs. So I have a bunch of different Italian songs. Everything from Zucchero, who does a bunch of duets with various artists, including like B.B. King and but also I like D'André, who does a lot of songs in the Genovese dialect, and they're very beautiful, kind of in the 70s. And it's embarrassing to admit, especially publicly on a podcast, but I've had this Neil Diamond fixation.
Neil Diamond. Okay. That's hilarious. That's really funny.
I told you this back.
No. No judgment at all. Okay. All right. Well, wrapping up just with a few more questions. First, what have been some of the guiding forces or role models that you've had in taking the path to where you are now, to being a CEO and a world-renowned professor and all these things?
You know, I've actually been reflecting on this a lot because, as I said, this is really, it's not just a transition for the company, but it's a long-term dream of mine to have this happen. I've been working on it for 15 years. And the transition to a for-profit, in many ways, was very awkward for me at first. So I have been reflecting on my inspirations, my mentors. One of them, Barbara Caulfield, who's now deceased, but I worked for her as a young paralegal before I went to law school. And then I worked with her as an attorney back when I was representing legal tech companies in the San Francisco Bay Area as a young lawyer. She's been amazing. I have to give a shout out to Jeff White, who's now a U.S. District Court judge, for whom I also worked as a young lawyer in San Francisco, along with Barbara. They were tremendously influential to me back when I was a young lawyer. And then I will also give a shout out to one of my most important mentors as an academic, who, if you ever listen to this podcast, will know. I think about 5 years ago, we were on the phone together, and the original title of Arbitrator Intelligence was where's some of my taste in music, the International Arbitrator Information Project, IAIP for sure. That's okay. You don't have to
see that. It just rolls off the tongue.
With Richard Susskind one day in London, and he was great. He gave me all sorts of really terrific advice, and he's such a smart, interesting, resource on this. And he goes, but your name is terrible. You have to change it. And so I was speaking on the phone with Professor David Wilkins, who's a big inspiration and mentor of mine. And it was late one night. I was telling him all these different things. And we literally together in this sort of almost conversation came up with the name Arbitrator Intelligence. And that's just, I think, symbolic of the little creative insights that he has helped me with along the way. So grateful to him. And I can't not say someone who's been a huge resource all along the way, and that's been Gary Bourne. Actually, I think my proudest moment in Arbitrator Intelligence so far was when Gary was accidentally mistaken for the founder. I thought, wow, we're doing really good. Because so many things Gary Bourne. But he's been incredibly patient in talking through number of details in reviewing drafts of the AIQ, in hosting events for the launch, for example, in London of our prototype. And if this project works, it really will be because of Gary's support over the years. So it takes a village, right? I couldn't have done this. And, inspiration actually for the project and talking about who made it possible, we wouldn't have the data we had, I've said it before, but without our ambassadors. I wish I could name them all right now, but I can't do that in the space of this podcast, but they are a tremendous group and an amazing resource that we would never be able to replace.
And, kind of rolling straight out of that, you've talked about, at the outset of all the things that you're involved with, from teaching, from being involved with the VSMOOT team at Penn State, with Arbitrator Intelligence and so on. How do you manage to balance your work-life balance in terms of your mentality, in terms of your physical health? For the folks out there that have a ton of projects as well, how do you balance that?
So, a really wise advice I heard once was that you don't try to balance every day. You balance, you have periods where you're just super intense working, at least that's how my life works, with no sleep and too much travel and being pulled in too many different directions. And then you have some times where you just go to a remote island and do nothing. So I have or spend extra time in your garden or painting. But I think that's a luxury of someone who doesn't have a family who depends on them daily, right? So I have a little bit of a different lifestyle because of that. But in terms of work-life balance, I don't have one. sure. But the thing I would say is that money's not particularly, I guess you're not supposed to say this when you're an entrepreneur, but money's not what motivates me, because I feel like people want to earn money so that they can buy things I like and do things I want. I just skip the money part and I do everything I want. Right. So it's hard to say work-life balance because in many ways my work is my life. Right. I love the stuff I do. I wouldn't trade any part of my – as a matter of fact, I just wish I had more time to spend more time with the VIST students, more time with – because all the things I do, they don't wear me down. They give me energy, especially arbitrator intelligence, but all of them.
Speaking of those students, let's say you are at a conference or an event, as you often are in this hypothetical situation, and a student or someone that is looking to break into the field of international dispute resolution arbitration walks up to you and they say, hey, Professor Rogers, you know, I'm trying to break into this field. You know, what advice would you have for that person in that moment?
So this is actually something, of course, we've been discussing, which is I think the best thing you can do, because you win even if you don't get what you want, is to create value in yourself. So to create, you create opportunities by improving yourself, right? So we talked earlier about writing an article, about writing an essay that turns into a blog post or that turns into an article, about learning a new language, about learning a new skill. Because the best way to connect with people is not with a handshake at a cocktail party, something called networking. The best way to connect with someone is on substance. Oftentimes it can be reaching out to people. You're writing an article and you've spent time working on someone's, you know, reading someone else's work that inspired some part of your article, and you send it to them and say, you know, your work inspired me. People always, you know, that is a tough one to resist, right? To understand if you're writing something, the one thing you want is people to read it and be inspired by it. And then if you can reach out to them on the substance of what you've written, right? It's a connection that's just deeper and different. So I would encourage people to, rather than trying to go out and meet all sorts of people they think can help them, instead try to create value in themselves that will make you attractive to the kind of people you want to give you a job, you want to meet, you want to be able to count us on as a colleague. And so the alternative I like to the idea of networking is establishing your professional community. And I think that just... that's what you should be trying to do. And that usually involves substance, not casual meeting. And that's why these young arbitration groups are so useful, because you think, you know, when we think about networking, we think always of networking upward. My very favorite Aesop's fable is the lion and the mouse. And most of my life, I've been a mouse, not a lion. If you don't remember the Aesop fable of the lion and the mouse, the lion catches the mouse under his paw, and the mouse begs, you know, don't kill me, don't kill me. And the lion kind of laughs and says, why not? And he says, well, because maybe one day I'll be able to do you a favor. And the lion thinks this is so funny, he lifts up his paw and the mouse runs away. And sometime later, the lion's caught up in a hunter's net. And the mouse comes along, and the mouse can chew through the net. Okay, so I think, you know, in my life, some of the most wonderful things that have come to me have been from networking downwards or horizontally.
Laterally, yeah, sure.
Yeah, not because, you know, your future, your current colleagues are going to be your future adversary, your future arbitrator, your future client. And you should always be, therefore, in a sense, cultivating them part of your professional community, rather than seeking someone higher up to exploit, to get an advantage from. So that's what I tell students. Usually they leave after the first three of those sentences, but you know, network with someone who's got a better answer.
He's more his punch. You know.
But I really do believe, and that's actually in some ways what underlies, you know, arbitrator intelligence, is that we all contribute to grow something together, as opposed to only just take away. So that's what inspires, I think, at a deeper level, the larger project. It's what inspires me on a daily basis. And I would strongly encourage people notice your values. You know, if you walk up to someone and you're in exploit, I want to get this, that's perceivable. So you should, again, work on making yourself the best you can be, and then offering that in a substantive way to build relationships that will last you a lifetime.
Done earlier with arbitrator intelligence. I have one more question about arbitrator intelligence.
I love questions about arbitrator intelligence.
Where do you see arbitrator intelligence in 10 years?
I really do. This is part of my scholarship. When I started out writing the article that produced Arbitrator Intelligence, which was, I think, nearly 15 years ago, I think Arbitrator Intelligence will reshape the entire market for arbitrator services. Right now, it is a market that is characterized by significant barriers to entry. How do you become an arbitrator? Well, you have to develop a reputation as an arbitrator. Well, how do you develop a reputation as an arbitrator?
Right.
You have to get appointed a bunch of times. But how do you let people know that you what you've done when you've been appointed, because it's all secret? And the other thing that characterizes the market is profound information asymmetries. Some people, the large, mega, multinational law firms, have access to a lot of this information. Some of the larger arbitral institutions have access to a lot, even though they're still limited. But the rest of us don't have access to a lot of information. And it seems to me that no matter how much you want to win the case, international arbitration exists and thrives because it is perceived to be a legitimate way to resolve disputes. And when you have profound information asymmetries, when you have a distorted market for arbitrator services, you, I think, risk losing at least some of the luster of that perceived legitimacy. And so I see arbitrator intelligence as fixing the market in a way that will promote and help international arbitration retain and even elevate that perceived legitimacy by making sure that in the most fundamental part of the process, the constitution of the tribunal, that there's a minimum baseline of information that everybody has access to, and that it provides some level of predictability and accountability in how arbitrators are appointed.
Sure. And, you know, we'll certainly aim to talk again within 10 years, but we'll mark that on the calendar and see if all that's been achieved is truly a noble ambition. I think something that will be a benefit for the community as a whole.
Well, thank you.
So, final question.
Okay.
It is 5 p.m., 6 p.m. on a Friday. No classes. You don't have any obligations to do for the business. Somehow the stuff's been taken care of by somebody else for the weekend. You can do whatever you want. How are you spending your weekend?
That's a mean question.
Save the hardball question for last.
I don't know, dream Friday night, if I'm here in town, because I'm often traveling, is to go home. I have this really cute little cabin in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
If it's wintertime, turn on my fireplace. Mm-hmm. If it's summertime, sit outside, maybe have a nice glass of wine, watch the birds and the squirrels, and then as the sun sets, the fireflies come out. But I'm a pretty homebody when I'm at home, don't do anything exciting, which is good because actually there's not a whole lot exciting happening in State College.
don't tell the Nittany Lions that.
You want to go to a bar? Maybe that's a lot of exciting. But I think for me, it is a pretty quiet place, but it's a beautiful place. And
sure.
So I tend to be pretty quiet. I usually work the whole work-life balance. I was exaggerating about the glass of wine. Friday nights, I probably usually work.
Well, before we get out of here, do you have any – I know you gave some shout-outs earlier in the show. Do you have any other shout-outs you want to give before we depart?
I think I would – right now, you know, what's on my mind is just how transformative, and I think that's really the right word, it has been working with Penn State. So James DeLautry, actually, we had these lovely debates. He's the one who's leader in the programs I'm working on, and where he sort of gently – nudged me into understanding there was no way I was going to make Arbitrator Intelligence work unless I converted it into a for-profit startup. And it was a reluctant transition for me, but he's a great persuader. So we have two rules. I have two rules with James. First rule, James DeLautry is always right. Second rule, if you have any doubt that James has made a mistake, go back to rule one. Because he has been so right in ways that I resisted and ended up having to come around to. But it's really his guidance and also Jim Pietro Paolo and Lee Erickson, Rachel Herder, and Tom Sharba. All here in Invent Penn State and in the launch box that we're sitting in, they've been fantastic in getting us off to a roaring start.
Well, no, that's great, and we'll tag the tag the folks that we can in the show notes. And so finally, I will give the shout out to our friend, our mutual friend in Florence, Mike McElrath.
Absolutely.
If you've made it this far into the show, Mike, hello from Penn State. So without further ado, thank you for tuning in to Tales of the Tribunal. It's been a great first season. We've really enjoyed all the great episodes we've got to do. Catherine, thank you for hosting us here in your facilities. And you want to sign us off?
Well, thank you for coming. And I am Catherine Rogers, and there's no disputing it. You are listening to Tales of the Tribunal.
Well, as you can hear, that was a fun episode to record up at Happy Valley, up in Penn State with Catherine. Catherine is a fun, and as you can tell, a deep wealth of knowledge on various topics of international arbitration, and in particular, data analytics in the field. So I'm excited to see where arbitrator intelligence goes from here and to continue to follow the work that Catherine has been working on. So that is this week's episode, and I guess this is where we bid adieu, at least for a little bit. As I mentioned at the show's outset, we will take a short break while we prepare the next little series of episodes that will focus on issues related to maybe some competitions in the world of international dispute resolution. So let's just take one final look at what the schedule looks like. So we'll take at least a week or two off to prepare those episodes. Then we will return in probably not until the movie, if I'm going to be honest. This week, as much fun as the show is to run, I do need to recharge just a bit. I need to find some new guests, and I need to prepare for season two. So with that, listeners, I really appreciate you sticking with me here over these past several months as we've been telling tales from around the world of international dispute resolution. And I look forward to bringing you more content in season two for these filler episodes in between. And in general, just telling more stories from our field. I hope that my goal, which was to share the stories of people that work international dispute resolution and show that we're not just, you know, stuffy lawyers that sit behind a desk all day, but that there are people behind those stories. I hope that that goal was achieved. And I appreciate those that have sent supportive messages, that have sent in constructive criticism, all of those things as I have worked on season one of the show. So that is it for now. We will take a short break, and we will see you guys in a few weeks. And don't forget, there's no disputing it. You're listening to Tales of the Tribunal.